Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. My guest today is Phil Klei. He's a veteran and the author of Redeployment, a collection of stories about the war in Iraq, which won the National Book Award. He's recently published a second book, a novel titled Missionaries, which is set in South America. His work has also appeared in many top journalistic and creative outlets. On Friday, October 8th, he'll deliver a talk titled Citizenship in an Age of Perpetual Conflict in the Tanner Lecture Series on Ethics, Citizenship, and Public Responsibility at the National Veterans Resource Center on the Syracuse University campus. The lecture is free and open to the public. Phil, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a great pleasure to have you. You know, your books are wonderful. It's exciting to have you on. Let me just start with Missionaries, your more recent book. How did you get the idea to write that?
Oh, God. You know, Missionaries mostly takes place in Colombia, but it also takes place in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Yemen. And one of the things, as I was sort of thinking about war and writing about war, you know, my entire adult life has revolved around war, whether as a Marine or somebody writing about the wars, it became very clear to me that you couldn't just talk about one conflict. You know, there's a scene late in the book where I have a Colombian mercenary who's looking through the optics of a Chinese-made drone coordinating over a Swedish communication system to an Emirati pilot who's about to drop an American-made bomb on Yemeni tribesmen, right? And that's not my invention. That's just what happens now. That's what war looks like in some parts of the world. And so how can you just talk about one conflict? And Colombia was a place that I'd studied. I was married there. I've spent a lot of time there. My wife is Colombian-American. We actually were just in Colombia with family for the month of August. It was really lovely to see folks. And so it was a conflict that I knew a lot about, but it was also one that the United States has been deeply, deeply involved in. You know, Colombia has been the largest recipient of military aid in the Western Hemisphere since the end of the Clinton administration. And one of the things that was very interesting to me was that tactics that were sort of began to be developed in Colombia migrated to conflicts like Iraq, and then took on a new form in Iraq, and then came back to Afghanistan. And so you'd have not just people who are going to, you know, on deployments to Colombia and then to Afghanistan, but also ways of killing, new ways of doing war that seemed very, very important to me for thinking about what war looks like in the 21st century and, you know, the role that America plays in the various conflicts around the world and how those are connected, which I think is really important.
So it sounds like you did quite a lot of research for this book. How long was it in the making? What kind of research did you do?
6 years, 6 years. Though I also had three children during those 6 years. So, you know, it wasn't like I was alone. You know, it was like Balzac would, you know, chain himself to his desk and drink like a mix of like bourbon and or some sort of alcohol and coffee or something and just write furiously. You know, that seems glorious to me. You know, you can't chain yourself to your desk when you might have to run after a toddler. So, but yeah, 6 years, 6 years, multiple trips to Colombia, interviews with, you know, special forces veterans, with diplomats, with Colombian military, Colombian politicians, people who grew up in paramilitary towns, you know, just trying to get a very broad sense of various theaters of conflict and how they're connected.
So your previous book, Redeployment, which is probably what more of our listeners are more familiar with.
Sure.
That's based on a lot on your actual experience and your actual observation, something that you lived. And as you've just laid out, Missionaries was extremely richly researched, but a different kind of enterprise. And I wonder if you could briefly reflect on that, how it affected your experience of writing it.
You know, it's funny. I served in Iraq, but, you know, when you turn something into fiction, even if you're drawing on your own personal experience, I certainly drew on my own personal experience for the writing of Missionaries as well, it ends up looking quite different by the time you put it onto the page, right? So the big difference to me wasn't so much in how personal it felt, but it was more in, you know, the fact that I was going from stories to a novel, and that the scope of what I was trying to do kind of radically expanded.
You're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Phil Klei, author of the books Redeployment and Missionaries. So both, though, despite the differences you just, or the similarity that you just laid out and some of the differences, both of those books, Redeployment and Missionaries, they do rely on a lot of first-person narratives. So as a writer, you are inhabiting different characters. I was wondering whether there was one character that was hardest for you to get into or feel comfortable with writing a first-person narrative for.
Yes, some of your children are more troublesome than others. So some narratives are straightforward in terms of how they think. So, you know, one of my characters, Avel, grows up in a town that has sort of been a battleground between left-wing guerrilla and right-wing paramilitaries. His family is killed in a massacre, and he ends up in the paramilitaries himself, and then connected to this guy who goes on to be a sort of intermediary in drug trafficking. And his story was sort of straightforward. You know, I knew where it began, and I knew where it was going, and it moved forward constantly. And then I had other characters, Mason, who's an American Special Forces veteran who spends time in Afghanistan and begins to be troubled by what he feels is the sort of drift of Special Forces, where they're increasingly used not for sort of building up host nation capacity, which is just a sort of fancy way of like trying to build up local forces and infrastructure of the country that you're in so that the country that you're fighting in can sort of take on those roles itself in the absence of American force. And he feels instead that Special Forces are just being used to kill people, right? Just being used to get into firefights. And it describes this very violent deployment in 2007. But he's sort of constantly doubling back on his memories, and the other military man who's a Colombian military man, Juan Pablo, is the same, where as they're sort of moving forward in time, they're constantly comparing what's happening to their sense of their own personal history and also sort of broader history. Juan Pablo has a sort of long discourse on a chapter where he talks about Che Guevara and his sort of relationship to Che Guevara and how he'd like his daughter, who's going to a left-wing university where he fears her mind will be poisoned, how she should understand him. And so that kind of narrative voice is more complicated and difficult to write, because you want to have the kind of layering of the past as the sort of present moves forward, but you want the narrative itself to be propulsive, right? You don't want it to feel like you're kind of constantly caught in digression so much as you want to feel like any time you're moving into memory, it feels incredibly vital for understanding where you are right now in the narrative. And so those were sort of challenging in a way that's kind of more technical. And it's not so much about kind of getting outside of your experience, right? I did a lot of research, and so I had a, you know, tremendous number of sort of sources that I could kind of reach to when I was trying to capture a particular thing that somebody had gone through, even if it was very intense. You know, there's a scene where Abel describes the experience of being tortured, right? But that's a little bit different than the kind of narrative style. And the novel is structurally complicated because it takes place in all these countries, and because I want you to see the connections, figuring out, you know, how this is going to move forward and how these individual voices are going to sort of navigate through the central drama of the plot, which basically revolves around what happens in this tiny region in a poor part of Colombia when American technology aids the Colombian military in killing a drug dealer, right? And that sort of raid happens in the middle of the book, which is, it's based on a real thing that happened where a drug dealer, a sort of drug lord, special ordered a 6-foot-tall teddy bear for his girlfriend, and the Colombian military put a beacon inside it so they could track the teddy bear to the birthday party. And then they hit the birthday party and killed the guy.
Wow. So I want to get back to your own military service. You were a student at Dartmouth College when you went to officer candidate school, and you were an officer in the Marines for 4 years. You had a tour in Iraq. You obviously had a lot of options in college. Why did you serve?
Because my country was at war. You know, my parents had always raised us to believe in service, and that understood broadly. You know, neither of my parents were in the military. My father was in the Peace Corps. My mother worked for years in international medical aid. But a sense of service and public spiritedness was very important. And you know, when I was in high school, I wanted to be a diplomat, like my maternal grandfather had been a career diplomat. But we were at war when I was at college, and that seemed to me like the way to serve my country.
And the dedication and redeployment, which is to your parents, says that they had 3 sons join the military in a time of war. You were obviously one of them. How did your brothers fare?
Very well. You know, they're doing great. So I'm one of 5 boys, and yeah, 2 of us joined the Marines and 1 joined the Army. Not sure what happened there, but they're doing great.
You're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Phil Klei, the author of Redeployment and Missionaries. On Friday, October 8th, he'll deliver a talk titled Citizenship in an Age of Perpetual Conflict in the Tanner Lecture Series on Ethics, Citizenship, and Public Responsibility at the National Veterans Resource Center on the Syracuse University campus. And that lecture is free and open to the public. Phil, you've spoken and written about your Catholicism and what particular aspects of the religious tradition speaks to you. The characters in your writing often have pretty complicated relationships between faith and duty. So I was wondering how your faith informed your military service and your experience there in Iraq, and also how it might inform your writing.
So I went to a Jesuit high school called Regis, which was a wonderful place. And the sort of unofficial motto is men for others, right? And so that sensibility was certainly something that was on my mind when I joined the military, right? To sort of fit in with those ideals of service that we were talking about before. You know, in terms of how it informs my writing, for me, the most vital works of literature, right, the works that speak the most to me, are the ones that are not just about sort of psychological or political or moral struggles, but about spiritual ones as well, right? And that not, you know, that need not necessarily be from a religious believer. You know, Dostoevsky is a touch point for me, but I think Joseph Conrad is exploring, you know, deeply spiritual questions at the end of the day, alongside political and moral and psychological ones, right? Camus, Bernanos, right? You know, one an atheist, one a believer, but deeply concerned with those sort of very basic existential questions. And so, you know, for me in my fiction, I try and dramatize that. And, you know, one of the characters, Juan Pablo in Missionaries, has a long chapter that details his falling away from faith, right? The sort of importance of religion to him when he was a child, and then the steps that led him not just to reject it, but ultimately to scorn religion, right? And it was important to me not to write that as, you know, a Catholic who's writing it so that you can dismiss Juan Pablo, but to really actually inhabit that perspective, right? When I'm writing, and again, to go back to Dostoevsky, you know, I always want to give the sort of ideologies and perspectives that are foreign to me their the richest and fullest expression that I can possibly give them. You know, in The Brothers Karamazov, Ivan Karamazov gives this sort of amazing attack against religion, right? In the chapters Rebellion and the Grand Inquisitor. And, you know, Dostoevsky later wrote, you know, the fools have ridiculed my obscurantism and the reactionary character of my faith. None of them could have ever conceived of so powerful attack on religion as I, you know, as I wrote. And it was true. You know, it's one of the most powerful attacks ever written. But he wrote it because for him, it was essential to grapple with the deepest and most difficult questions. And whatever you believe is worth nothing if you only engage with sort of pale and ridiculous versions of, you know, ideologies that are threatening to you.
Mm. I picked this up off the internet, but I thought it was a very interesting quote from you about how civilians mm-hmm. and veterans need to interact with each other. And I wanted to read it to you and get you to reflect on it perhaps a bit more. Here it is. Veterans need an audience that is both receptive and critical. Believing mm-hmm. war is beyond words is an abrogation of responsibility that lets civilians off the hook from trying to understand, and veterans off the hook from needing to explain. You don't honor someone by telling them, I can never imagine what you've been through. Instead, listen to their story and try to imagine being in it, no matter how hard or uncomfortable that feels. In the age of an all-volunteer military, it is far too easy for Americans to send soldiers on deployment after deployment without making a serious effort to imagine what that means. I think that's very interesting and insightful. Do you have any reflections on that that you'd want to add here?
Yeah, I think the first op-ed that I've wrote for the Times, and I still feel very strongly that's the case. I think we sometimes think that, you know, experience of war is beyond words, or, you know, you hear veterans say, you know, you weren't there, you could never understand, or civilians will tell you, as one friend told me, oh, I could never imagine what you've been through. And yet, I think that actually it is important for us to imagine, right? As one veteran who'd been severely injured and had a series of intense experiences said to me, you know, what if I want you to imagine what I've been through? What if it's important to me that you try? And, you know, listening to what somebody has been through, listening to somebody's, you know, lived experience, as the parlance is today, does not mean uncritically accepting everything that they say, right? We're all flawed human beings. I suppose this comes back to my Catholicism, but, you know, we're all prone to self-delusion. We all tell ourselves stories about ourselves that flatter us or conform to the sort of ideological way that we like to carve up the world. And that's why you want to actually engage with other people who don't see yourself the same way you do, who might have, you know, perspectives that can enrich your sense of even what you've been through, right? Even if they're coming from a very different place. And I found that, you know, many, many times talking about war, talking to civilians who've never been to war, but who have experiences that they relate to the things that I've written about, that sort of show me corners and avenues of human experience that I'd never even considered. And so that can be a very valuable process just personally. You know, as a friend of mine who did multiple deployments said, you know, it frustrated him when people told him, oh, I can never understand what you've been through, right? Because that suggests to him that his wife will never understand what he's been through. His children can never understand what he's been through. And he says, that means I can never come home, right? Really. And I don't want to come home, right? And I want to be able to share what is most important to me with those I love, and I don't accept that it's impossible. Now, that's important personally, but it's also important politically, because all too often, the American public defers to the military, and especially, I think, sometimes to generals, despite 20 years of the track record, let's just face it, not being particularly good, right? And if you're an American citizen, you have absolutely every right to talk about war, to question. You know, you should try and be engaged and thoughtful and informed, right? But Never allow yourself to be mystified. Never allow yourself to think that, you know, only those who serve have the authority to talk about war and what we should do. Every American citizen has the responsibility to think about what we should do and how we're using military might, because when America kills, it kills in all of our name.
Hmm. If you just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, and my guest is the writer, Phil Klei. We've got a few minutes left. I want to try to squeeze three or four more questions in here if I can, but on this issue of questioning and citizens critically holding leaders accountable, there are a lot of veterans who Yes. have expressed frustration over aspects of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, the final Mm-hmm. withdrawal. And I'm just curious, what were your own thoughts and feelings about the final U.S. exit from that country?
So I supported the exit from Afghanistan, right? I thought that, you know, if after 20 years you can't create a government that won't fold the instant that we leave, then another 20 years is probably not going to do it, right? The institution that we were propping up, the Afghan government, we had organized in a way according to our vision of what the government should look like, rather than anything that was going to have long-term legitimacy or functionality for the Afghan people. And so we poured money into it for 20 years, and that was a lot of that was a waste, right? I think that the people who thought that we could sort of maintain the status quo with just a small number of forces were utterly delusional, right? The Taliban had steadily been making gains. At best, if we'd kept troops there, we would have slowed things down and then had to withdraw not much later, but under even worse conditions. So I think it was fairly obviously the right thing to do to withdraw. The frustration that I have that made me furious was that we did not adequately plan for getting people out, especially for American allies, right? And so you had this insane, chaotic hustle with all these sort of private citizens joining organizations or trying to help coordinate people through. People were like reaching out to Marines in Afghanistan on those Marines' Instagram accounts to try and tell them that they had, you know, Afghans at the gate who were trying to get through. It was utter chaos. And look, it was always going to be bad. And the Trump administration deserves a huge amount of blame for really just not allowing people to come through, not allowing visas for Afghans of people who helped us, so that the backlog just got much worse during the 4 years. But the Biden administration did not adequately plan for this. And everybody in the community, in the veteran community who has advocated for these visas for years, knew that this was coming. They knew that this was coming, and yet that fell on deaf ears until the crisis was already upon us. And so that was extremely frustrating to me. And I think that, we still have obligations towards those folks who have come in, right? There are a lot of Afghans now in America who, you know, if you're interested in that subject, there are organizations that are helping them get settled, but there are also a lot of people still over there. That is a failure, right?
Jacqueline Witwicky is a student who helps me with this program, and she wanted me to ask you this question. I want to try to squeeze another one in after this if I can. But in redeployment, there's a lot of harsh, sexualized language that is directed at female characters.
Yes.
How true to life is that depiction, and do you think anything can be done to address that issue?
Yeah, and that was very deliberate. Right. I mean, there are some of the stories in that book are more about sexual violence and just sort of very distorted versions of masculinity than they are even about war. I'm thinking of a story like in Vietnam, they had whores. It's very directly about that. Right. And I wanted to show that. That is definitely a part of military culture. Right. It is an ugly part. I think there has been progress. I think that, on a variety of fronts, that, you know, women have fought and clawed for, but it's definitely a still a huge issue, and that's why I made it a significant part of redeployment. I wanted to show that, in a sort of harsh light.
Mm. And just a little bit more than a minute left, but I want to return to your lecture here coming up. Again, you're giving this free public lecture at Syracuse University on Friday, October 8th. Don't give us the punchline necessarily, but what are you going to reflect on there?
When we withdrew from Afghanistan, the president declared that the war was over, and then in the next sentence declared that we would continue to kill people in Afghanistan using over-the-horizon strikes. What does it mean to be in a nation where we're regularly killing people in many countries, but we claim that we're not at war, and the wars happen mostly out of sight, and we only really find out about them when something goes very wrong? I think that is a deeply important moral question for all American citizens to think about, and I'm going to reflect on the current state of American war and how we should feel about it as Americans.
That was Phil Klei, and again, his most recent book is titled Missionaries. He'll be delivering the Tanner Lecture on Ethics, Citizenship, and Public Responsibility on October 8th at 4 p.m. at the National Veterans Resource Center on the Syracuse University campus. The lecture is free and open to the public, and the lecture hall there is large and will allow social distancing. I'll be there too. So put on a mask and come join us and get your book signed. Phil, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me here today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations, conversations in the public interest, is hosted and produced by Grant Reher. Assistant producer is Jacqueline Witwicky, and the program is edited by Mark Lefonier. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program and to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.